Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit brooklynslate.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, broadcasting to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn for episode number 110. I am full swing in the holiday spirit. I have had so much fun in my cooking classes at NYU. We've been baking cookies, and the Landlady Holiday Spectacular was this weekend, and I hear that it went amazingly well, and someday I will make it to an event in the city at night. On a school night, but this was not the one. But a shout out to all of you guys. I'm glad that you had so much fun, and thank you again for coming on Heritage Radio Network. On the heels of that show, I have joining me in the studio. I want to jump right into it because normally I start by talking to myself for a little while first. But
jump in. go all the way. Let's do it.
Joining me is Andrew Smith, who has edited a new... do you call this an encyclopedia?
The encyclopedia sounds too, academic.
But I miss encyclopedias.
This is A to Z. It is organized like an encyclopedia. But we tried to be light and airy and fun.
We
succeeded. Yeah, I think so.
It is called Savoring Gotham, A Food Lover's Companion to New York City. Now, this book was delivered to my front door, and the minute I opened it, I was like, oh my God. Like, I grew up in New York. I'm a big New York geek, and I love New York history. And like every page that I flipped to, I've been like, oh my God, this is so fun. So I want to ask you first about two of the specific things that you guys have written about, and then we could talk about sort of how you made the book and how you decided what was in it, and then I want to talk about the nature of food writing in the food media landscape. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Okay. I was teaching this morning. I still have my like teacher hat on. I'm like, this is our lesson plan. This is what we're going to get through. Okay. So the first one that I want to talk about are black and white cookies.
They're good.
Huge part of my childhood. Did not know that they were a New York City specific thing.
What? There's no evidence that they were anyplace else.
My husband calls them half moon cookies.
Ah.
Okay, so can you tell me the story of the black and white cookie?
Well, the answer is we don't know for sure about its origin. People claim that it was not invented here, but it was certainly created here and sold here in New York City in the early 20th century. And that seems to be relatively well established, but it really didn't become an important part of New York City life until after World War II. So you have a huge gap from when at least stories of origin claim things were created until the time that it became popular. And then, of course, it hit high popularity when it hit the TV shows in 1993.
Wait, what was that? Was that Friends?
No. What
did I miss? Yeah. Oh, Seinfeld.
Don't you remember Seinfeld?
Yes. Okay. So we just started watching Seinfeld from episode one because my husband and I have each watched chunks of it. But there are huge pieces of cultural reference that I miss, like the black and white cookie significance.
Seinfeld has a number of different food references that are there, and of which many of them have taken off. So, yes, but that received national visibility. And then New Yorkers who had been consuming black and white cookies for decades prior to that time all of a sudden said, oh, we've got something really good here. And that's then when all of a sudden Starbucks and other companies began making a version of black and white. And they're not a true black and white, but they're close, you know?
So let's describe what a true black and white cookie is, because I have traveled and
good
gotten
luck.
Them, and they're not. Okay, so the way that I understand a black and white cookie is that it's a vanilla cookie that you then turn upside down, so the rounded part faces down, and then you glaze half of it with
bitter chocolate,
and the other half with
vanilla-ish.
With lemon in it.
And lemon or orange. So orange
flavoring
too.
Okay, yeah, I can get behind that. Here are some of my pet peeves.
Yeah.
if a bakery puts the white coating over the whole cookie.
No, it's not a black and white.
It's not a black and white.
It may be a cookie. It may be good, but it's not a black and white. I mean, we've got tradition. We got history, you know?
when I was little, and it was rare that we would go out to dinner, but when we did, my father would order a steak, and he'd pick up the steak and see if the grill marks were cross-hatched on both sides. And he said to me, like, that's how you know someone cares about their cooking.
Is this the beginning of your chef's life? Is this the beginning? We need to know when the real origin.
Both my parents are incredible cooks, and I started cooking from the moment I could see over the stove. But there are these little
points that you remember,
and that's one of them. When my father pointed out, like, that guy cared. That, I mean, we assumed it was a guy. It probably was. That guy cared because no one was going to see the bottom half of the steak. And I feel like the black and white cookie with the vanilla. Over, or the white coating over the whole top.
No, that's just not it.
Now, here's the other one. It should not be chocolate frosting.
No.
I've seen this out in the world. I'm like, that's not a black and white cookie.
Yeah, well, there are black and white cookies, and there are black and white cookies. I mean, personally, I mean, I really like a vanilla flavor, and many of them don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just taste like sugar coating,
right?
and white something or other, white coloring that they put in. And I like the bitter chocolate and the real vanilla flavor. And when you get both of those together, that makes a true delicious black and white cookie.
We are lucky enough to have a bakery by us out in Morris County in New Jersey that makes excellent black and white cookies. And everything else in the bakery is terrible. A borderline inedible. But for some reason, they love the black and white. Like, you can feel the passion in the black and white cookie. So much so that now as I'm saying it, I wonder if they don't have them shipped in. Because the rest of the stuff is coming out of, like, number 10 cans. And I can't do it. Because that was also my first job, was in a mom and pop's bakery where things were not treated with love.
That happens.
Yeah. The black and white cookies were amazing. So if you are in New York City and you have access to them, do you have, like, a preferred black and white cookie establishment that's your go-to?
No, I don't. Sorry. Okay.
No, that's all right. I think, I just go and if there's one, I'll pick it up.
I go to a bakery, places that actually makes their own, as opposed to a place that sells them. And so frequently there are two very different things. And I've sampled many, many different black and white cookies, and some I like and some I don't. So
I would say anything that comes pre-wrapped, like in a cellophane sleeve.
That's not a black and white cookie.
You're setting yourself up for disappointment.
Right.
Okay, so the other thing that you talk about in the book, which is a little bit of a topic shift, but that I want to see the return of, are oyster bars.
Well, good luck. first of all, for a quick history, in the 19th century, New York City harbor area, which includes the Long Island Sound, had, the best estimate is 50% of the world's oysters were right here. And then we historically, collectively, destroyed those oyster beds so that there are none active in the harbor area. Certainly in the Sound there are. Now, the really good news about that is that there are now rebuilding oyster beds in the harbor, not to eat, but to remove pollution from the harbor, which is a good step forward. So my hope is that maybe my children may be able to sample once again the oysters of New York City Harbor.
I'm reading Mark Kurlansky, right? Kurlansky's book, Oyster. And it was amazing to me. There was a... I'm still only in the beginning, but he talks about how there's evidence in the oyster shells that were being consumed before Westerners settled here, or, you know, explorers came over, that even then the oyster populations, they could tell by the archaeological record, were being threatened because the biggest oyster shells were on the bottom of the pile, and then the smaller oyster shells are on the top of the pile, which, like, indicates that people are eating the bigger oysters first and then eating smaller and smaller oysters.
You have huge mendons of all of these oyster shells that are all along the coast of Long Island and along the coast of eastern North America. So wherever there were oysters, they were hot items for summer and fall consumption.
So what made an oyster bar quintessentially New York?
Well, in the 19th century, there were almost 1,000 oyster bars in New York and in Manhattan alone. So that's the important thing. And then virtually anybody who wanted to make some money could go into the harbor, could fish out the oysters, and could sell them on the street. And so you literally had hundreds, if not thousands, of street sellers that were making these available. So that was the first thing. Now, the oyster bars themselves tended to go into certain areas. So Canal Street, for instance, became the oyster bar sitter of Manhattan for decades, in fact.
Why Canal Street? What was it that drew the entrepreneurs there?
Who knows? it's just where people congregated, and they tended to be underneath a store or another residential area, and so they would take anything that they possibly could get. And the Canal Street Plan, which was the popular 19th century program, 12 cents for all the oysters you could eat. But if you ate too much, the proprietor was going to slip you a spoiled oyster and...
That would be the end.
And that would be the end. You would then decide it's better to leave here than stay. So,
yeah. Oh, that's so funny.
But that was common throughout the 19th century, and you had some very popular oysters in it. And it was these bars were the places where both the common people as well as the well-to-do went. And New York was pretty separated between those different classes and different ethnic groups and different immigrant groups. But in the oyster bars, it wasn't. Whoever showed up, men and women and children and African-Americans, and it made no difference. Everybody went, and that was one of the few places where all New Yorkers congregated without any prejudice. And that's a fascinating part of their history.
Yeah. I love the idea that you could just be walking and then I don't know. It has this like speakeasy vibe, but windswept at the same time. I love the idea. And I certainly hope that the oyster bed reconstruction happens. There was a video going around Facebook of two fish tanks, both of which were filled with New York City water. And then into one, the person put a handful of oysters. And in like 72 hours, the water was completely clear.
Right.
And that's incredible.
Still can't eat those.
But
the good news is they take the pollution out of the water, put it into the shell. So when they die, the shell is no longer in the water. So it's a good way to cleanse the harbor and also make areas for fish. So while you can do some fishing now in the New York City area, obviously with new oyster beds, you will have many more fish to catch.
That's amazing. Okay, so we need to take a quick break. Let's do that now, and then when we come back, I want to talk about how you go about compiling such a masterful work.
Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hattica. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. We encourage you to visit brooklynslate.com for more. You can also get your own Brooklyn Slate care package by becoming a superfan member of Heritage Radio Network. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate for more.
Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. You know, every Tuesday at 3 p.m., I stop in the studio, walk to the far side, sit in my favorite blue chair. If you ever stop by Roberta's, look through the window, and you can see that chair itself. You know, and I've been sitting here for 5-plus years, 250 episodes, have met some of the best people in the food world, such great culinary minds. And recently we just relaunched our website, added a whole bunch of shows, but we still need you, our listeners, our friends, our fans, even guests themselves, to help us out. We're a 501c3, a nonprofit, and we're not really doing this for the money. We're doing this for the love, for the greater good of the food world as a whole. So get on heritageradionetwork.org, click that little pounding heart in the top right corner, and you know, give what you can, or just keep on listening. We'd love to have you.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson. Joining me in the studio is Andrew F. Smith, who has edited Savoring Gotham, A Food Lover's Companion to New York City, on top of many, many other books and writing credits that you have to your name.
It's a tough job. Somebody's got to do it.
So I get asked fairly frequently, how do you get to do what you do? So I'll ask you that question.
Be in the right place at the right time. That's the only honest answer to it.
Yeah, I say be nice to everyone because you never know who you're talking to.
Well, I think you need to do networking. And I mean, I teach food writing at the New School. And one of the encouraging things that I give students all sorts of tips. And one of the things, have your own card and go to the events, hand your card out. And the person going to get them usually going to throw them out. But they give you their card. And then you follow that up. And so you need to constantly network. And the only reason on why I've been as successful as I have in the writing area is simply because I network. I still network.
Yeah,
20 years later, 25 years later after I started writing, I'm still networking.
Right. I think that's a misconception, is that there's an arrival destination. Like there's a point at which you're done. Like I think that that's one of the things that I've learned. Like, no, you just have, you're constantly hustling. You might hustle in slightly different areas, but for the most part, so you have 100, did you say 175 contributors?
174 contributors.
174 contributors to this book. What did the early days of planning what this was going to look like? Like, was there a color-coded post-it note system, or how did you decide to undertake this?
We had a group of people that met together, and one of the things that we did was brainstorm potential entries that we thought needed to go into it. And then from that group, a group of editors were selected, and we have a number of advisory editors, and Kathy Kaufman being the associate editor for the book. And so what we did was we started with the list, and then we started putting names beside the list, the people that we knew. And then we sent the list out to the people that we knew, and they then commented on it and said, well, you stupid jerks, you missed this, and that should have been here, and why are you doing this? Which was great. I mean, that's exactly what we wanted. And so we very quickly expanded the number of entries, and we expanded the number of contributors. And we had probably about 150 potential entries that we would have loved to have found contributors to have written. We only have about 40 ethnic / immigrant / religious groups represented as entries, and there are 180 language groups in New York City alone, and most of them have food traditions that we would have loved to have included. And likewise, I think we have about 80 biographies of historical and current figures, and that could have been expanded dramatically. And so in their regions, there were many of us that when we live in a particular area, we know we can write that entry, or at least we can edit it if somebody else writes it. But there were large numbers of regions that I've never been to in New York City. And so it was a while to figure out how to, get contributors to come in and talk about the regions. And I think we would love to have expanded that too. So our real hope is that this is a first statement, and it's the best statement that we could make at this time. It took us only 2 years, which is by comparison to other projects like this, it's a very short turnaround time with 1 year of writing and 1 year of production. So, but it was fun. It was fun from the beginning to the end, and people, and even to the last few weeks before we had to get all the entries in, people were still suggesting new entries.
Oh wow!
And if they could do them, my reaction was, let's do it. Let's get it in there. Things I'd never thought of. None of us had thought of at the beginning.
So is there a plan for a second edition for all those other things?
I'm planning a second edition, whether Oxford is or not. That's another issue. It needs a second edition. And as you well know, New York City will be celebrating its 400th anniversary in eight or nine years. And my hope is that at least we could have a masterwork that corrects any mistakes that appear in here. And people have already told me that there are three mistakes on this, and that's okay. And we want that. We want that interaction coming back, because they may or may not be mistakes in the first place. And secondly, people have information and access to sources that that the author may not have had. So we want interaction with people, and we want people coming and telling us things that they should have put in there that we didn't.
Yeah, I was going to say, are they actual mistakes, or are they like
Yes.
Opinion mistakes.
They're both. but even the opinion mistakes are good, and it gives you a different insight into the subject. I mean, one of the things that we intentionally did was limit entries to a maximum of 1,000 words, and some of them are only 200 or 150, and you can't include everything in there. There are some factual mistakes that have been already pointed out, which can easily be corrected, but there are other mistakes. People say, well, this should have been in that entry, and so, and they're all right. And so those are the interactions that we really do want out. But it's 730 pages and 560 plus entries, and it was a labor of love for everybody that was engaged in it, and it was fun for us to put it together.
And it is currently available, right? People can go out and buy it?
It is currently available from Oxford University Press. For if you get it in there very quickly, you can get a nice discount.
Oh, okay.
Or from Amazon. And the last I checked on Amazon, there were only 3 copies left, so people got to get out there and start. Wow, there are more on order. So
wow, that's huge.
And
congratulations.
Barnes & Noble and bookstores here in the New York City area. So, it's currently available, and it's a perfect holiday gift.
It is a perfect holiday gift for anyone who loves New York City food, is in New York City, is not in New York City, and wants to feel like they're a member of the community. I mean, it's just like, it's such a perfect thing.
Oxford never has published something like this. They've done nation and they've done area studies, food related things like that, but they've never done a city study. And so one of the arguments that I put forward was there are 56 million tourists that come to New York City, and they're not as familiar with all of the sites and all of the history of New York City, and that this would be a good target for them. So we hope that that will be a great market for the book.
I 100% think that it will. I mean, I can imagine 10 people sending this to people who were like former roommates. I have a roommate who used to live with me in Brooklyn, who is now in Colorado, and she will get a copy of this, and it will make her like, oh, I remember all of that stuff. And like, it's wonderful. So I want to change topics just briefly, because you have such a wealth of experience in the publishing industry and the cookbook industry. And I'm wondering if you can, from your perspective, what is the current landscape of real books? What does that look like?
It's changing quickly. So I guess that's part of the story, and trying to keep on top of what the changes are. The good news is that print food books are not going out. A number of other subject areas are declining rapidly in terms of print, and they're all moving over to electronic. But in the case of cookbooks, for instance, there's a 10% decline in print cookbook sales over a period of about 10 years, which is minimal. So you can still get books published. And in the past, you had these big publishers, and they only wanted a big name, and they only wanted a book that was going to sell, at least 100,000 copies on the first run. And now you've got a lot of small publishers that are out there that are really looking for good food books. And so in one sense, from a diversity standpoint, I think that there are more food books, not necessarily cookbooks, but there are more food books being published by traditional publishers today than in the past. Now, the quantities are less, but the total number of books are more. And that doesn't even count the self-published books, and which a number of people that I know have really great ideas, and I can't think of a publisher that will do it. So self-publish it. And some of them made a fortune doing the self-publishing. You know, I'm saying, what did I do wrong on this process of advising them to take us? If you know how to promote it, if you have your target already known, you can self-publish. Publish and you can do extremely well, and then you have total control over the book. Or depending on the publisher, you can get assistance from editing, and you can get a lot of copyright work and lots of other. You can buy those services that are helpful. So to me, it's food writing is blossoming today in ways that it was not blossoming even 10 years ago.
You mentioned in the intro to Savory in Gotham something that I sort of struggle with, which is like the amount of information that's out there. And how do you advise your students, you know, people who come to you for advice or mentorship? How do you either cut through that and find your own unique take on, you know, be the 50th person to write about donuts or whatever it is, and also not get overwhelmed by the, like, everything's been written. I mean, and I fall victim to that. I'm like, forget it. Everything's been done.
I had written a book before on New York food, New York, a food biography, New York City food biography. I thought I knew everything that there was to know about New York. I have 1,000 pages of notes. In fact, that's when I went to Oxford and said, listen, we got a big story here, and it's you can't tell it in 40,000 words. You got to tell it in extra. And much to my surprise, there is no entry, almost no entry in that book that has something that I didn't know and had something that surprised me or a twist on something that I thought I knew. And so all I can do is say for everybody that said everything's been written, the answer is no, it hasn't. And you need to figure out how you can take traditional topics and twist them in new ways. And it's possible to do that way. So it's not just the academics that are doing the traditional work of looking at all of the and having great footnotes, which I do in my other books. But it's also people who are creative and looking at new things. And there's no day in New York City that something new doesn't pop up. And it may be the Cronuts gets the visibility. but there's also this is a very creative place, and the create every day something new comes up. And some of it, you know, we won't think about it tomorrow, but many of the things are going to be shaping food trends for at least America and perhaps the world in the near future. And so I think this is a great place to be a writer. It's a great time to be a writer, and it's a perfect time to be working in food.
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, to answer the question that I started with, which is like, how do you get to do what you do? I think a lot of it is just comfort in not needing the stability. You know, like if you're going to make a go of being a writer, like I think it's a benefit of having a pretty chaotic childhood that I don't have any expectation that I'm going to have everything laid out for me. But it's really heartening to hear you say what you've just said, which is there's room there. Everything's not been done.
Everything has not been done, and I would say we probably tapped a very small percentage of the things that we should be writing about. So I think there's a huge world out there, and there's a new world coming along, and it's that, to me, that's what also is exciting and why I love to be a teacher at the New School, is simply because I get these students that come in with all these crazy ideas, and I'm sitting there going, wow, I never thought about that. And that, to me, is one of the reasons on why it's exciting to be in food writing now.
I sparred with one of my vegan students today. And she's very quiet, and she almost never talks, and she never eats anything. She cooks everything without complaint. It's a hands-on cooking class. But for the first time, and maybe it's because it's our second-to-last class, she was emboldened to kind of challenge me on some things. And it was like, I'll never get bored of that. You know, like that conversation and that debate will never get boring. Because I asked her, she was very, very peaceful and sweet. But I asked her she ate honey, and she said no, and you know, because of the commercial honey production, she had all of her like talking points. And I said, well, what about the honey that like my bees, like I have 3 beehives, would you eat my honey? She's like, yeah, but that's different. And I was like, see, that's a story for you to write. That's a story for a vegan student to write about, you know, understanding the difference between commercially produced something and...
There's a great entry in Savor and Gotham on beekeeping in New York City. You can now raise, legally, you can now have keep bees in New York. So I want you to know there will soon be honey from New York City. You know?
Right, yeah, zero mile honey from right above your head. We have beehives here at Roberta's Pizza, as a matter of fact. I have one quick question that I wanted to see if you knew the answer to. I read some factoid somewhere that if you try to eat out... If you tried to eat in every restaurant in New York City and you ate out breakfast, lunch, and dinner, the human lifespan is not long enough.
Well, I tried to do that once in my life, but at least the big name restaurants. Right. There are 50,000 restaurants in New York City, and that doesn't count a lot of the smaller places. And so I figured out if I ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner at several different places, not just once a day, but several different places, I could still not make it through the entire group by the time that I would move on to the next world. So all I can do is say, and that's what's exciting too. It used to be a lot of the restaurants were similar. They're big name restaurants, and then there were frozen food that they put in the microwave. And today you can walk down a block and get really fascinating ethnic food that wasn't available even 20 years ago. So that's why, again, I'm still excited. I'm really excited by food and the trends that are going on and all the new things that are coming out. And even those who are vegans and even those who are raw food is, and even those who are dumpster diving. I think that's exciting. That's great.
Yep, I agree. Are you doing the cookbook conference this year?
We're doing a food manuscript, cookbook manuscript conference.
Ooh, can you talk about it?
Well, yes, we have May 12th and 13th for 2016 scheduled at Fales Library at NYU.
Okay.
And we're looking for people interested in working with us on cookbook manuscripts. And we've defined a cookbook manuscript as something that must have at least 12 recipes and has to be at least 50 years old. So those are our criteria. So we've left it open as to what they include. So Fales Library has hundreds of them. And they have, I don't know if you're aware of this, but 4,000-year-old glyphs that they brought in that with food-related things on it. And most people aren't aware of the things that are there. The New York Public Library is incredible with a large number of manuscripts. And we've got a huge resource here that most people are not aware of. And part of it is to look at their problems of dealing with manuscripts and their benefits of looking at them and looking at the relationship between manuscripts and published sources. So there are all sorts of things that we thought we would do everything we could to get some visibility for it. So for this year, that was it. But last year, it was New York City food history. We did that at the new school. So
all right. And I assume Bonnie Slotnick will be in attendance?
I sure hope Bonnie's going to be there.
I'm such a huge fan of Bonnie Slotnick.
She now has 4 copies of Savoring Gotham. I took them there yesterday. I just want you to know. So. And if you look at the beginning of the book, you will see that she edited parts of my entries. So I'm always thankful for Bonnie for a lot of
reasons. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. Can I call you Andy on the air?
You sign your email. Emily, it's okay.
Okay, good. You sign your emails, Andy. So Andy, thank you so much for coming on Heritage Radio Network. This has been super enlightening. I have to say, I wish that my grandfather had lived long enough to see this book, because this would have been the kind of thing that he would have just loved every minute of, because he was such a tried and true New York eater. So thank you for putting it together. Thank you to your 174 people who have contributed to it, and I very much look forward to Volume 2. Until next week, everybody, thank you so much again for listening. We are in the heart of our membership drive for Heritage Radio Network. If you haven't already, please go to heritageradionetwork.org, click the beating heart in the upper right-hand corner, kick us a few clams. We rely on the support of listeners like you to continue doing what we are doing and getting fascinating guests to come in and talk about the world of food and cooking. And I couldn't be more thankful to be part of it. So do that. That's on your to-do list. Have a wonderful week. This weekend, I am making jambalaya and setting up my Christmas tree.
What time do you want me over?
Friday night. You come over Friday night. There will be oyster and tasso jambalaya.
We'll see you. I'll bring some good wine. How's that?
Sounds amazing. Okay, everybody. Till next week. Thank you so much for listening. Keep playing with fire and knives.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.